Now, this passage is actually quite a significant one in John's Gospel, because it sits right at the end of Jesus' public ministry. After we get to the end of this passage, he then goes and spends his time in the upper room with his disciples, and then goes to his death. So after the close of chapter 12, Jesus will never speak to the crowds again. So these verses have been carefully chosen by John to form the bookend to Jesus' public ministry. So we need to look at exactly what John has decided to place at this pivotal point in his gospel. Well, he's included two chunks. The first in verses 37 to 43, which in my Bible is entitled The Unbelief of the People, deals with belief. Who has believed and who has not believed and why? And then the second chunk in verses 44 to 50 is the last speech of Jesus's to the Jews, which summarizes and condenses all that he's been saying to them in the preceding 3 years of his ministry. In other words, it is a summary of what it is they need to believe. And so this passage is just as key for us now, both as we look around us and consider just who is going to believe this gospel message, and as we decide what we need to hold on to ourselves and then say to others when we proclaim that gospel. Before we look at these two sections, it's worth just taking a step back and looking at what has been happening in the preceding days of Jesus' ministry. We know that 5 days before the Passover feast, Jesus had set his face to enter the city of Jerusalem for the last time. He knows that this time his trip to the capital will end in his death at the Passover feast. And so he knows he only has a few days left. And he decides to use only the first part of his remaining time in speaking to the wider Jewish people and their leaders. And the rest of it he reserves just for his 12 disciples. This time, unlike his previous trips to the city recorded in John's Gospel, where he seems to have been careful to keep the crowd's reaction to him at least in some way under restraint, this time he's made no attempt to do so at all. He has entered Jerusalem in the most public of all ways, riding on a donkey, which, as we saw last time, is a symbol of kingly status, through a cheering crowd who are all acclaiming him to be the King of Israel and the Son of David. And he then proceeds to the temple, and once again he throws out all of the merchants, the money changers and the salesmen there. And in his public teaching that follows, he openly takes on the Jewish leaders, speaking a series of parables that are directed against them in condemnation. And then he trounces them in public debate as they come to him with questions to trick him. And then that debate itself ends in his pronouncing a further series of very blunt condemnations of those same leaders in front of the people. And as he fully intended, this enrages and frustrates in equal measure those Jewish leaders, taking their hatred of him to a boiling point, which only then needs the intervention of the betrayer Judas to turn them to arrest him, sentence him, and execute him. So while all this has been going on, how have that crowd, that great mass of the Jewish population, which has swelled far beyond its normal size by the Passover feast, how have they reacted to it all? Well, at the beginning of chapter 12, when he enters Jerusalem, a large number of them are cheering for him and they're hailing him as their Messiah. But as the week goes on, their certainty seems to just melt away. When later Jesus turns to these crowds and tells them that he is about to die, they can't understand how his death can square with his being the Messiah. And once more, they begin to question who he is and whether he can be what they'd seem so certain he was at the beginning of the week. And then this uncertainty turns into outright hostility by the end of the week as they cry for his crucifixion, clearly no longer believing that he's any sort of Messiah at all. So what had gone wrong? How can they have made such a mistake? How can they have failed to recognize their own Messiah when he came to them? Well, we can and we do make all the excuses in the world for them, along the lines that they were expecting this conquering hero to come and throw out the occupying Romans, not someone who was going to get killed. And the conquering hero had seen such a distinct possibility in their minds when he'd ridden into Jerusalem on that donkey just a few days before. But when he fails to take it any further, when he doesn't lead the people into a full-blown uprising against the Romans, they begin to have their doubts. Doubts that then turn into a certainty when their own leaders arrest him and find him guilty of blasphemy. And then at that point, at the end of the week, they're filled with all the rage of those who feel they've been deceived. And they join their leaders in condemning him to the most painful of deaths because he's just not the sort of Messiah sent from God that they were looking for. But the thing is, excuses like that just don't wash. They should all have known better. Their own scriptures contained all the clues they needed as to the true nature of their Messiah, including his death. So you have the suffering servant of Isaiah 53, the pierced one of Zechariah 12, the holy one who was taken from the grave in Psalm 16, and the forsaken one of Psalm 22. And then there was the teaching and miracles of Jesus himself. How could someone do those things if they weren't from God? And Jesus himself in John 10:38 calls on them to believe because of these miracles, even if they struggle to believe what he says. But instead they just tie themselves up in theological knots as they try to square the belief that he's not the Messiah with the evidence of their own eyes of what he was doing, claiming that these obviously godly miracles are the work of Satan. So why did they fail to believe? Why did the Jews not recognize their own Messiah, the one they'd been longing for hundreds of years? Well, that is exactly the question that John deals with in this first section, in verses 37 to 43. And what is John's answer? Well, he says it was all to fulfill the words of a prophet. In fact, the very same prophet who had so clearly described the death of their Messiah to those Jews. And John states very clearly that the prophet Isaiah's words about their rejection of the Messiah were not spoken as a result of some sort of foreknowledge that God had given Isaiah of how the Jews would react in the future. No, it's the other way round. Just look at what it says in verse 39. Therefore, they could not believe. It was the fact that God had spoken those words all those years before that meant that the Jews could not believe in the Messiah in the first century AD. Isaiah was just reporting what God had said, and God had ruled back then that he would blind their eyes and harden their hearts so that they would not be able to see when the Messiah he was sending came for them. So God had decided in the 8th century BC that the Jews would not be able to recognize their own Messiah. And that is why in the face of all the scriptural evidence and all the testimony of Jesus' miracles and his extraordinary life, they just couldn't get it. In fact, worse, they ended up deciding he was a fraud and had to be killed. But isn't that all a bit unfair? Why would God not let them recognize their own Messiah? Well, those passages from Isaiah in our passage tell us. The first in verse 38 says, Lord, who has believed what he heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Well, that quote, as your footnotes will tell you, comes from the 53rd chapter of the book of Isaiah. A chapter that sits within a wider section of the book describing the coming of the Messiah who is sent by God to rescue his people. In that section, the people of Jerusalem are told to rejoice because their king is coming to free them, to buy them back from slavery. And while part of their slavery is being under the control of foreign powers, actually it's made very clear that their real slave master is God, who has put them into slavery because of their own disobedience and sin against him. And that the king, this Messiah, is coming to deal with their sin and because of that release them from their slavery. But the book is clear that he will do this by being despised, rejected, and unrecognized by the very people he's come to rescue, who will cast him off, cause him to be killed, and then bury him. And that is why John quotes these words, Lord, who has believed what he heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? The answer being, no one. Yet, as it says in verse 10 of Isaiah 53, it was the will of the Lord to crush him. For the life of this king that they reject is the very price of their rescue, the offering made to God to deal with their guilt. So one answer to why God didn't let the Jews recognize their own Messiah when he came was because they could not. If they had, they wouldn't have killed him, and so they wouldn't have been rescued. He needed to die for them to be saved, so they needed to be blinded to who he was so that he died. But John also gives us a second reason for God's blinding of his own people, and that is found in the second quote from Isaiah in verse 40 of our passage, where it says, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts, lest they see with their eyes and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them. Now, I was interested to find out these words are actually the most quoted verses from the book of Isaiah in the whole New Testament. As well as appearing here, they are in all three of the other Gospels and also in the book of Acts. In Matthew, Mark and Luke, they are quoted in a passage where Jesus is explaining to his disciples why the people cannot understand the parables that he is teaching them in. And Jesus tells them in the words of Mark 4:11 that it is because the Jewish crowds are not in his kingdom. And he uses this quote from Isaiah to make the point that therefore they just cannot see or understand what he's teaching them. In other words, the people in these crowds have not been brought into the kingdom of those rescued by their own saving king, and so they cannot hear or understand that king, who is Jesus. And again, we must ask, why? Why are they not in the kingdom? And to understand that, we need to look at this Isaiah passage in its context. So it comes from Isaiah 6, and that chapter is set right at the beginning of Isaiah's ministry as a prophet. And it describes how he was first chosen by God to deliver his words to the nation of Israel. It includes his commissioning speech, in which God outlines the main themes of everything that Isaiah will tell the people and that are recorded in the book. This describes how Israel lies under the judgment of God and will continue to be under that judgment as they are punished for their sins against him. But even as this punishment is being worked out, God at the same time will be announcing to them the way to be forgiven and restored. But they won't be able to hear it or understand it. And that very inability to understand or listen is part of that judgment. And that is why John quotes this passage in our section, and why Jesus quotes it in those passages in the Gospels, because even as the Jews long for rescue, at the same time, they won't be able to see the rescuer when he comes to them. And that's part of the judgment upon them from which they're seeking to be rescued. So the second reason why God won't let the Jews recognize their own Messiah is that it's part of his judgment on them for their disobedience to him. A disobedience that has stretched far back into their history. And in case we should sit there and think, well, it's just restricted to the Jews, we need to remember that what is true for the Jews, whom God has chosen to be his people way back in Abraham's day, is even more true of the rest of humanity. For all mankind lives in disobedience to God and are therefore under his judgment. Just as with the Jews, that judgment includes blindness to being able to see God. A blindness that means that we also cannot recognize our rescuer when we see him, or understand who he is when we hear of him. For the rest of mankind need this rescuer just as much as the Jews do. So as we look at ourselves and the world around us, we need to remember that very truth. Just like the Jews of the first century in Judea, even if Jesus were to come now and to heal the sick, or feed the 5,000, or walk on Petersfield Lake, or raise the dead, even then we would still not believe in him. Nobody would, for we are all blinded by God. So Is there no hope? Were they? Are we consigned forever not to understand, to be blind? Will none of them or us see? After all, what on earth is the point of sending a saving king if he saves no one because everybody remains under judgment for what he is meant to be saving them from? It's surely pointless. He may as well have not come at all. Well, chapter 6 of Isaiah also provides a hope for mankind that is to be filled out in the rest of his prophecies too. In verse 11 of Isaiah 6, a prophet asks, "How long, O Lord?" In other words, how long are people going to remain uncomprehending, blind and dull of heart? When will they be able to see and understand? When can they be saved? And God then says, until. And in that one word, there is hope. The judgment will not last forever. There will come a time when a rescue will come and a time when the blindness will be lifted. And God then goes on to say that it will be when his punishment has run its course. And then the salvation will come, and it will come from a seed that grows up within the Jewish nation. And with the salvation will come a lifting of the blindness. But it will not be the whole Jewish nation that is saved. Instead, it will be only a part. But added to that part will be people from all other nations. And so God's people will become multinational and multiracial. And as God then unfolds in the rest of the book, that seed that he talks about is the Messiah. And now we come forward to the Gospel of John. The rescuer has come, and the rescue is about to happen. And what we're asking is, would the blindness also be lifted so that the people can see and understand and actually be rescued? Well, the beginnings of such a hope are seen in verses 42 and 43 of our passage in John. The answer to verse 39's, "they could not believe," is verse 42's, "nevertheless, many even of the authorities believed in him." Despite the disbelief of the whole, there are still stirrings of belief amongst many within the Jewish nation. And yet, even with these, there are reservations. For the rest of verse 42 and verse 43 informs us that they kept their belief secret because they feared man more than they feared God. And they loved man's commendation more than they loved God's commendation. So who were these believers? And were they true believers or were they not? Was this finally sight coming to the blind? Or are they still under the judgment of blindness because they still don't understand fully? Well, to know that, we need to know more about who these believers were, who feared. Who were they? What happened to them? Did they continue and grow in their belief? Was their ability to see made complete, or did they stay in their blindness? Well, we actually know who two of them were. For amongst the Jewish leadership, there was a pair of men who fit perfectly this description. After Jesus' death, John 19 records the following. After these things, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave him permission. So he came and took his body away. Nicodemus also, who earlier had come to Jesus by night, came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds in weight. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen cloths with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. And Nicodemus, you will remember, not only as the member of the Jewish authorities who came to Jesus secretly at night in John chapter 3, but also is the one at the end of chapter 7 who tries, rather discreetly, to stand up for Jesus in front of his peers. And Joseph of Arimathea was also a member of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council. So clearly we have these two men, both believers, but both who feared the Pharisees. And at least one of them, Joseph of Arimathea, is described as good and righteous in Luke 23. And no one is described as good and righteous in the Bible unless they are among God's people. And that was almost certainly true of Nicodemus too. And here we have them taking a risk for Jesus, going to ask for his body to honour it, even though it would have angered their own colleagues in the Sanhedrin if they'd known about it. So are they both true believers at this point in John's Gospel, when they are amongst those describing as believing, but also loving man's glory more than God's? Well, the answer is both yes and no. Like so many in the pages of the Gospels, they have a genuine belief, but it has yet not fully formed. The promise to lift the blindness is beginning to come true, but it is not yet fully realised. And we only need to look at the disciples themselves for this, 11 of whom were undoubtedly believers when they died, but who have a very checkered history in the Gospels of belief. They're first said to believe in Jesus in chapter 2 at the wedding of Cana, when he turns water into wine. But then, when it comes to the feeding of the 5,000, they struggle to understand. And actually, Mark says they couldn't understand because their hearts were hardened, which is the language used in those Isaiah passages of unbelievers. But then at the end of John 6, they believe that he is the Messiah, despite many of the other disciples falling away. And in the upper room, in the next couple of chapters' time, Jesus calls them believers, at least in the fact that they know he's from God. But then John describes himself as believing only when he sees the empty tomb in John 20, implying that he hadn't before. And yet they're all said not to believe when Mary and the two disciples who'd been on the road to Emmaus say they've actually seen Jesus alive. And then even when Jesus appears to them, they initially can't believe it's him. And even as late as Jesus' ascension in Acts, they still don't understand that he's going back to heaven and he won't be creating an earthly nation state then and there for them. But from the day of Pentecost onwards, there is not a trace of unbelief amongst any of them. Instead, they see in full who Jesus is, that he is the Messiah who died and rose again for the forgiveness of sins. For this was one of the promises of God, that he would pour out his Spirit so that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. Because it was with the coming of the Holy Spirit of God that the final and complete lifting of blindness became possible. And we can see that amongst the rest of the Jewish people, even those that crucified him. For many after Pentecost see and understand what was previously closed to them and are added to the rapidly growing church. And this included even many amongst those Jewish authorities, just as John 12 had said. For again, after Pentecost, the book of Acts records in chapter 6, verse 7, that a great many of the priests joined the early church. And in Acts 15:5, that it included Pharisees as well. And then later still, increasingly vast numbers of non-Jews when the apostles are sent to the nations with the message of the Messiah and his rescue. But even these foreigners, these Gentiles, do actually show the beginnings of the lifting of the blindness in the pages of the Gospels. In fact, the only group of people in the Gospels who, wherever they are mentioned, are unequivocally called believers from day one are foreigners or Gentiles. So remember those Samaritans in that town at Sychar who believe after hearing Jesus' words. Or the official in Capernaum together with his whole household after Jesus heals his son. Or that centurion, again, after Jesus heals his favourite servant. So if blindness in John 12 is lifted at Pentecost, so that disciple, Jew, priest and Gentile alike are all able to see and believe in their Messiah as he really is in all his fullness, who only weeks before had not seen, had not believed, hadn't understood, had deserted him or even killed him, then if this blindness has been lifted, does that mean that everyone can now believe? No. Because God lifts the blindness only from those he chooses, and he does not choose everyone. Many of the Jews in Jesus' day died still blind, and so did many, many among the Gentiles. And that is still true today. That judgment of blindness remains for those he chooses not to lift it from. And can we say in response that that just isn't fair? Why does he choose to give sight to some and not to others? Well, the answer is twofold. First, our blindness is of our own choice, as well as being his will. As it says in Romans 1, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them. In other words, just like those Jews in John 12 who did not believe, though he had done so many signs among them, so it is with mankind as a whole. The truth about God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit has been made abundantly clear to mankind through the testimony, as we were thinking about earlier on, of the universe that exists around us, the testimony of our own consciences, and most of all, the testimony of his word in the Bible. But man has chosen to ignore the truth in order to please himself. And so he is without excuse. He can't complain of ill treatment because God has blinded him when he's been given every evidence of the truth. But the second answer is that God is God. It is his to choose, not ours. He made us, he sustains us, and he owns us. It is not for the slave to command the master or the object to control its owner. God chooses whom he chooses, and that is his right as God. But we do know with John that whoever receives Jesus, whoever believes in him, will be given the right to become children of God. So there we do have a right. We have no right to choose who is given sight. But we have the right, once we see, to become children of God. So if we see, if we believe Jesus' words to be true, then we can claim that right to be a child of God. So move to the last few verses of the first half of John's Gospel. And these are the very last words that Jesus will speak publicly before his death. So they're very loaded. Except he doesn't actually speak them. Verse 44 says that he cried out, a word including both passion and volume. For example, it's used of those crying out to Jesus to heal them in the Gospels, or by those shouting, "Crucify him." And then it's used about Jesus himself on the cross when he cries out in a loud voice and yields up his spirit. There's nothing subtle or discreet about Jesus' last speech. It is to be declared to the Jewish people at full volume. And so what does he shout about? Well, a summary of exactly what he's been saying to them throughout the whole book of John. He starts with, "Whoever believes in me believes not in me, but in him who sent me. And whoever sees me, him who sent me." This has been one of his main points to the Jews. I and the Father are one. You cannot believe in God without believing in me. And you cannot believe in me without believing that I am God. Any claim of theirs to be the people of God, to be the children of God, without recognizing him, Jesus, as not only from God, but God himself, are utter nonsense. And not only nonsense, but damning heresy as well. And the same is true today. If you do not recognize Jesus Christ as the Messiah, as fully God, as one with the Father, then you do not know God, and you cannot claim to know God. Try shouting that out like Jesus on the streets of our capital.